You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org. Hey, Van, how you doing?
How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, happy to have you on. Why don't I go ahead and start by introducing us? So I am Connor Eccles, the managing editor of Non-Zero and the host of the weekend edition of the Non-Zero podcast, which we are currently on, Non-Zero World. You are Van Jackson, a senior lecturer at the Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand, and a senior non-resident fellow at the Center for International Policy. You have a ton of affiliations, but another one that I might highlight is that you are the author of the always excellent Substack newsletter, Undiplomatic, as we can see behind you. In many little places. I like the background, as well as the Undiplomatic podcast, of course. So did I get everything? I covered the house.
That's great. The newsletter was the most important, I guess. So
exactly. That's the cross promotional opportunities are one of the things that we really pride ourselves about here at Non-Zero. So I'm glad we could be of service, but anyway, so I've had you on today, obviously, to discuss your new book that you co-authored alongside Michael Brennis, which is titled The Rivalry Peril, How Great Power Competition Threatens Peace and Weakens Democracy. That's going to be the main topic of the conversation, though I think I might try to ask you a little bit about sort of your path in your career as well, because I'm curious to hear sort of about your shifts that you experienced from being sort of almost a member of the foreign policy blob in a sense, right? To a pretty sharp critic. You know, you worked as a policy advisor at the Pentagon under President Obama and have had a pretty substantial history now of being very, very critical of obviously US foreign policy. So I think maybe we'll talk about that later. But just to start us off, I think a key argument of your book is that essentially American policymakers misremember the Cold War, and that informs a lot of bad policy today. So can you start by just telling us what people get wrong about that era of American history?
Yeah, sure. So it was when we started, my co-author and I, Mike Brennis, when we started seeing policymakers like reach into the bag of history and pluck specifically like the Cold War metaphor out. It was this laundering or legitimating rhetorical move. And then we would look at what they were doing in the name of this sort of Cold War struggle that they were recalling. And we noticed both that like the metaphor itself was misplaced, or like the history that they were calling forth from the past to justify the present. It was like cherry picked history in a bad way. And then at the same time, the stuff they were doing in the name of this cherry-picked history was just unequivocally bad stuff. And like in my own analysis, I was like, this is like pretty anti-peace, anti-stability. Like this is accelerating American decline at best.
Yeah.
And we started sort of like accumulating evidence of that, Mike and I both separately. And then when we would commiserate about it, we were like, you know, there's a project here. Like somebody needs to correct the record on this stuff. So basically we saw the way we framed this up was like, there's a right and a wrong Cold War metaphor. And the wrong one is the one that everyone thinks of in Washington, which is like heroic struggle, democracy defeats communism, right? We won, freedom won. And that's really misremembering what the Cold War was. Like nobody should want to repeat it. Like the right metaphor to the Cold War, the one that I think is operative now, is to invoke the Cold War as a global regime of violence, exclusion, secrecy, hierarchy, all justified on the basis of geopolitical rivalry, right? So it's this abstract great game that sacrificed without consent between 14 and 20 million people. And it almost ended the entire planet multiple times. You know, that's the right Cold War metaphor. The Cold War was a mechanism right. for militarism and for weakening the working class and for empowering right-wing demagogic politicians. And all of that, incidentally, is happening now. So if that's what we mean by the Cold War, it's totally happening. And that sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to spell out more kind of how, you know, obviously we'll get into all this more in detail, but sort of how some of those misconceptions, because people actually, you know, people in Washington will often grab specific aspects of the Cold War, the original Cold War, and kind of apply it, obviously, to the new, I guess we'd call it a Cold War at this point with China, right?
Yeah.
And I'm kind of curious to get a few sort of examples of how those misconceptions really play out in policy today.
There's a lot of ways into that. So like, when we were in the war on terror in the Obama years, we had inherited that from the Bush administration, obviously, and the entire national security state, which is this sprawling apparatus that costs trillions of dollars. Like, the defense budget is currently approaching $1 trillion, and it was, you know, half that back then. But the entire national security state in total is in the trillions of dollars. It's a massive, massive enterprise, you know, and it was geared entirely toward this global war on terror, pockmarked by a couple actual no shit wars that we were doing. And the Obama administration takes over all of that, doesn't really wind any of it down except temporarily in Iraq. It 10x's the drone strikes campaign program. I mean, 10x literally, like it went through the charts of killing people with drones. And so we started noticing that there was kind of like popular backlash against this. And so this is when I was actually in the stew, in the system, you know? And so at one point I was an actual national security strategist in the Pentagon. And like, one of the things we were trying to think about was like, the war on terror is a loser. Like, even by our own metrics within the national security state, we weren't meeting a victory or standards of, there was nothing good about it, you know, like, you know, the number of Salafi jihadist militants like quadrupled during the first 15 years, 16 years. So like, there was all kinds of problems with the war on terror, but the national security state we took for granted was a good thing. We thought we were doing God's work. And so how do you reconcile that? Everything that you're about is producing bad outcomes. And the more you look at it, the more it looks like we are partially the cause of that. And then at the same time, at a meta level, you believe that what you're doing is necessary and good just as a philosophy. Like, God forbid the national security state didn't exist, you know? And so we needed to figure out a way past the war on terror, but without actually confronting American exceptionalism and the idea that America can do no wrong kind of thing. And China was a godsend to the national security state in that respect, because it allowed us to move past the war on terror without any kind of sober, serious reflection. It allowed us to retool, redirect all the energy that we directed at the war on terror and to just direct it against a new type of enemy, but not only a new type of enemy, but a new type of enemy that allowed us to reach back into what we were most comfortable with. So the national security state itself is established in 1947, right, under Truman. And so like, it was designed for a Cold War against a singular superpower. Like, that's what it's set, that's what it optimized for to begin with. So like, we're super, as strategists, as military thinker types, we're super comfortable playing the great game, spy versus spy, balance of power, espionage, missiles, all that stuff. That's a world of comfort. The war on terror was actually quite uncomfortable because it was an asymmetric kind of war that was inherently unwinnable. But because we believed that we came out favorably in the Cold War, because we all sort of took for granted the Frank Fukuyama kind of end of history narrative, We saw the Cold War as having been a good thing, something that like, gee, if we could do that again, which we were designed to do in the first place, that wouldn't that be great? And then we cherry picked a couple things that did that were good from the cold during the Cold War period. They weren't good because of the Cold War, but like the National Security Education Act, it like funded public universities in a way, you know, in the 1950s, right. You know, the Civil Rights Act, the Cold War denied and delayed civil rights for Black Americans and for women even. But there was actually like in a very narrow tactical way, the Civil Rights Act got a boost from Cold War competition because, you know, you couldn't have the entire South of America basically be an apartheid region and then engage in like, and then the Soviet Union is like backing struggles of national liberation in the third world, you know, and like the narrative battle there was too lopsided. And so like the Civil Rights Act got a boost in that sense because we wanted to play geopolitics better. And so there's these little bits of history that were positive that happened within the context of the Cold War that we decided to like laser focus in on and be like,
right,
man, if we could do that again, if only we could do that again. And so during the Trump years, you had the national security state wonks, the Jake Sullivans, the Kurt Campbells, people who would go on to big things in the Biden years. They spent those years on the bench in the Trump years, basically misremembering what happened in the Cold War and using it as a kind of like mental map for how Democrats can do primacy and national security in a way that like offers some promise of like building up the middle class. And right.
The idea that like competition lets us basically, it brings out our better angels, right? Like we need to be in competition in order to advance.
Yeah. Which is, that's totally misremembering the Cold War too, because like it was the Vietnam War that defunded the war on poverty, you know? And in fact, like we wouldn't have gone down the path of neoliberalism when we did starting in the 70s had it not been for the like dynamics around the Vietnam War. And so like this idea that, and you know, the right-wing politicians in America at that time during the Cold War, anti-communism was the reason to fund the national security state at crazy levels. And funding the national security state at crazy levels was the reason that the same Republicans used to not fund the welfare state, you know? Right. And so like, even in the Cold War, but especially currently right now, you don't see the outside threat bringing Americans together. You see it as this wedge issue that actually divides people, divides politicians, divides the parties, you know?
Yeah, it might be helpful here too, sort of as we're thinking through this, to look at sort of the timeline maybe of this new Cold War, how it developed. If I sort of read your book right, I think you saw the seeds of this, you know, ignoring the aspects about the sort of history and structure of the national security state, the seeds of this idea seem to have really come in the 90s and then developed, I think, really through the like recession in particular caused a lot of the tensions to, the Great Recession caused a lot of the tensions to rise. Can you sort of walk through how we went from the sort of idea that we could cooperate with China, that they could be aligned with us in certain senses geopolitically, and how that shifted?
Yes. So there's two angles to this. I'll try to keep them sort of brief. But one is that with the end of the Cold War, American grand strategy became very explicitly about primacy, right? Mm. And sometimes it would be draped in sort of like liberal institutional rhetoric or human rights rhetoric. Sometimes it wouldn't be, but it was always primacy. It was always about the ability to like dominate and overmatch all comers, any potential peers. And if you saw any power sort of like rising to catch up, that was going to be like an existential threat, all hands on deck. That's what primacy is, you know, like it's an extreme power hoarding within the world system as an end and means of policy. Very lopsided, predatory way of relating to the world. So that became American grand strategy, and it never stopped being American grand strategy ever since the end of the Cold War, all the way through the Biden years, right? So what happened in the sort of Bush-Obama years, though, was that there were all kinds of like our soft power started declining with the Asian financial crisis in 97, 98. The Iraq war, the Iraq invasion made us wildly unpopular, right? Countries started like soft balancing against us. So you started seeing signs of that. The global financial crisis in 08, it lends itself to this narrative that, you know, America is in kind of secular decline, you know, in the long arc of history. We know that no empire or hegemon lasts forever. So maybe now is just our time, you know, and China was actively promoting that narrative anyway at that point. And then we go into the Great Recession. We never really recover. It is disproportionately America's fault, you know. So anyways, all of that was happening and it was challenging naturally American primacy. So like we had a grand strategy of primacy that was only conceivable in a unipolar world, in a world where the global distribution of power already favored us. We could do a strategy of primacy. Is that advisable? Right. I would say no, right? You know, like that's not a good thing in my mind, but you could still do it. It's rational, you know? And what was happening, depending on when you date it, it's either 97 or 2003 or 2008, but at some point, the world started becoming more multipolar. And there was a diffusion of power rather than an extreme concentration of power. This meant that the global distribution of power was deeply, materially incompatible with America's grand strategy. And so the way that we responded to that in the national security state was to live a lie to some extent and say, no, the world's not becoming more multipolar. You know, like we're still in the unipolar moment. And you see people like William Woolforth at, I think he's at Dartmouth. He's still to this day in 2024, he's still making those arguments. It's like, no, it's still a unipolar world. It's like, dude, what are you smoking? You know, like even Marco Rubio knows it's a multipolar world, you know? So like,
I mean, definitely, at least in economic terms, it's pretty impossible to argue any different. Like, I get how you could say that the U.S. is definitely the most powerful military force in the world. But I mean, economically, it seems hard to argue.
Yes. And there's actually a funny point to mention on this military thing, because it's true that America is the global dominant military power. As it happens, in the context of specific scenarios where we would imagine fighting a war, which one of which is obviously the Taiwan Strait, starting in the Bush years, military strategist types started recognizing that military technology itself was changing in a way that was unfavorable to primacy. So even though we were still and remain today like this unbelievable military power, the geography of the Taiwan Strait is such that, and it intersects with military technology in such a way that we cannot actually prevail without resorting to nuclear war in a normal military sense. We cannot dominate that area because of the advent of precision-guided munitions, so like missiles and drones, basically. And that technology makes power projection over long distances, which is what America does, very hard. So you try to project aircraft carriers or something over 6,000 miles, well, all it takes is a few accurate missiles to get past your defenses. And it's like, boom, you can't project that power anymore, you know? Yeah. So in a raw military sense, also separate from any choices we were making, the world was going from unipolar to multipolar. And so that galvanized what in the Pentagon, we started calling strategic competition or great power competition. And that language comes into being we started saying it publicly in 2014, which was the last year I worked in the Pentagon. And that was the beginning of great power rivalry in earnest from the Pentagon perspective. There is a separate way of explaining Sino-US rivalry itself, which we can talk about, which is like very much more economic. But in terms of like the national security calculation, that's sort of how we got to this point.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, on the economic side, are you pointing to the, you discuss in the book at some length this idea that obviously China has this very export-driven economy that it is sort of in some ways in response to the ways in which the U.S. pulled back. It's sort of what we asked them to do, right? But then it goes into overdrive after 2008, right? So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, do you want to put? Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, the short version of this, I'll try to be even shorter. You know, the neoliberal economic order, everybody knows, has created massive inequality in the world. It's been producing less and less growth. So as the dividends of globalization stopped paying off, the U.S., China, and rich nations that can afford it, which is basically just here and there in Europe, they have they've basically decided that, like, the answer to an era of low growth is zero-sum economic nationalism, right? And China was really pioneering this in a way. Like, in 2015, they declared this, like, Made in China 2025 thing, and it was, like, basically insourcing high technology, innovation, and development, and that kind of thing. State-sponsored capitalism, you know? And that's what America is now mirror imaging. So what China was doing first, America is now doing. And it's in political economy world, this is what's all sexy and in vogue, right? So states that are powerful are mobilizing to grab a greater share of a shrinking global economic pie. Like, it's just that simple, right? But to do that means you have to compete with other states who are also doing that. And that is Sino-US rivalry, right? And in order to do that, to compete with other states also doing this shit, you have to stoke nationalism. There's no way around it. But stoking nationalism is, of course, antagonistic, right? Both China and the U.S. are doing it. The wrong kinds of politicians benefit from that. This is a process that doesn't end well for anybody. And it's being driven by the economic realities that were created by the neoliberal economic order that we created, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you're pointing to sort of these circular dynamics that go back and forth between the U.S. and China. Obviously, we influence each other very much, and there's sort of a vicious cycle that you lay out there. I'm kind of curious, sort of from the perspective of Washington, and maybe this is only natural to a certain extent, but there's a lot of blame game, I guess, right? There's a view that what Washington is really doing is responding to an increasingly assertive China that is arguing that it should overtake the U.S. in some sense on the world stage, at least as an economic power, if not necessarily as a military power, right? And I'm kind of curious how you think about, you know, how you think about the rise of obviously Xi Jinping, who's very distinct from previous Chinese leaders, and sort of how you know, how you apportion blame for where things have gone wrong.
Yeah, I don't really talk in the language of blame, even in the book. Because it's like the moral freighting, people can agree or disagree or whatever. I don't find it super useful. But, like, causally, I think there is a misunderstanding that's happening, and it has to do with this nationalist lens, or, like, my flag versus your flag lens, which is bad analysis, like, literally bad analysis in a world of, like, interconnected capital flows. You know, like, we live in a capitalist world system. There's no such thing as, like, national capitalism versus world capital. Like, that's a fake distinction. You know, like, China is in the position, I think you alluded to this, but China is in the position that it's in as the world's factory because America went through a process of American politicians supporting deindustrialization and, in parallel, the financialization of the economy. This is how we end up equating advanced economies with service-based economies, because we pushed all of our production and manufacturing into the third world. And we did that for the sole reason that we could exploit cheap labor there, because they didn't have strong unions or workers' rights or environmental protections. And so it was a cost-cutting mechanism, you know, and it had the double benefit of disciplining labor in America. And it forced American workers and global workers into this race to the bottom, you know, who could work for cheaper, who could work for worse conditions. You know, they're the ones who get the contract, kind of thing. And so that's, like, a real, that was what neoliberalism was, and why so many people are so critical of it on the left and the right, you know. But China was, that's how China became the world's factory, because it was the chief beneficiary of that process of deindustrialization. So what's happening now with American politicians who, I don't know if they're willfully ignorant or if they're just lying or what, but like, this was a process that American politicians made happen. And now that it's happened, China has been able to develop and grow, and we are not happy with the consequences of the decisions we've made. And instead of understanding that and understanding that like we exist in relation to them and that we have made choices that led to China being something we don't like, instead we have been scandalized by the whole thing and we've just blamed China. And that's right. Causally, that's not accurate. That's bad history. You know, and the problem with that in a practical sense, it's not just like gee whiz historical stuff. Like it means that we're like misdiagnosing the current moment. You know, like China, there's a lot of stuff they do that we don't like, you know, gray zone, maritime militia stuff, the, you know, human rights violations against Uyghurs. There's, I guess you could go on and on, espionage stuff. All of that is those are symptoms of geopolitical rivalry, right? Mm-hmm. Like those things are inherent to, they are expressions of having an antagonistic relationship with another great power in the international system. Yeah. We mirror image that behavior, but when we do it, we think it's okay, you know? And so like, this is the fundamental problem. It's like, we see things that we don't like, we are scandalized by it, but we don't inquire about why it is. We simply attribute it to like, well, China's evil and therefore it's time for a new Cold War, baby.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it is. You do get the sense that there's just so much enthusiasm about that. But I guess maybe we should make a little bit more concrete sort of the different types of damage and bad policies that this has encouraged in practice. One thing we can come back to sort of how this has negative effects on the U.S. and how it encourages us to do stupid stuff abroad. But I'm also kind of curious if you could spell out some of the argument that you make in the book around how this is bad for Chinese people too, right? For like many citizens of China, the economic system that they're in encourages basically accumulation of wealth at the highest levels of society and sort of prevents a transition towards something that would help to lift even, you know, more Chinese people out of poverty, things like that. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So China, like to support this system of export-based growth, export-based national economy, you have a handful of like state-selected basically oligarchs, you know, corporations that have state backing that hoard tremendous amounts of wealth and surplus value. Like they capture all the profits. It's an oligarchic system effectively. And in order to make that system run, they engage in like pretty terrible labor repression. And one of the ways that they do that is by ensuring that the Chinese like proletariat or the Chinese working class, like they cannot organize independent unions. It's illegal to build working class power except through the one state sanctioned federal union, and that union reports to the CCP. So in effect, the only unionization that exists in Chinese labor is reports to the party itself, which means that the party has total control over the fate of the larger working class. And this, they use that to make sure that even as productivity rises in China and they adopt new technologies so that they can produce more, they produce more and more cheaply, and the wages of Chinese workers don't keep pace with productivity. So over the past 20 years, the standard of living for Chinese workers has increased, and that's a good thing, but it has not kept pace with productivity growth. Mm. And that's a bad thing. And that's because they don't, I mean, like you hear these horror stories about like, you know, working in Foxconn factories and like the slave labor conditions that exist in certain factories. And like, I should stress that like one of the reasons that, I think that's important is because there are mirror image versions of that that exist even in America. And the difficulty of criticizing that, it deserves criticism when China creates slave labor conditions and represses its workers and doesn't let them go on strike and, you know, people can barely get by. And so like tremendous economic insecurity, you know, they have a massive youth unemployment problem. People can't afford to buy a house. That sure sounds like America. You know what I mean? And so like, yeah. If you're Gen Z in China, you've got a hell of a lot in common with Gen Z in America, you know, because the prospects are bleak and your political class is basically selling you patriotism and ethno-nationalism, you know? Yeah. And so like, it's those parallels that are the real peril to me, you know? And like our inability to see that, that we're mirror imaging them, that's a similar kind of situation. You know, our ruling class is doing this to us, just like China's ruling class is doing that to them. The failure to see that makes us feel scandalized when we see China engaging in these repressive behaviors, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like this need to look in the mirror for the sake of better analysis, because then you can have a better diagnosis of the situation and then you can have better prescriptions for how to actually resolve it instead of make it worse. One of the, maybe you might have been about to ask this, but like, one of the problems is that with the larger situation right now is that America is responding to China in ways that make the problems with China that we see and don't like worse, you know? Right. And that's because we have a bad diagnosis of the situation.
Yeah, and it's interesting too. This is kind of a side note, but one just really striking stat that you mention in the book is that, you know, America has responded in part to this competition with the resurgence of industrial policy for the first time, the resurgence of a strong kind of hand for the U.S. government in economic policy and in sort of trying to guide industries in how they make investments and stuff like that. But what's really interesting is that this massive investment, you know, $204 billion, I think, is what the book says, between CHIPS and the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, are only going to get on the high end about 82,000 new jobs in the US, because these are super inefficient. These are very important industries in the minds of American policymakers for competition, but they don't create a lot of jobs. And so the result is that we spend all this money, and I did the math on that one, and it's like $2.5 million per job, which is just astonishingly inefficient, right? It's like hard to wrap your head around, because it, you know, like a green job, the general estimate that I've seen around that to create a new green job is like 100 to 150,000 in clean energy. So we're talking about more than 10x to create each job here.
Yeah. I mean, so there's this funny historical puzzle that people overlook, but it's like, how did America's, I mean, now all of our environmental, everything is dead under Trump, of course, but how did the environmental effort, the like, combating the climate crisis in America, how did it take the form of this really unambitious project to basically surge the production of electric vehicles and like basically nothing else, you know? Like if that's the entirety of our contribution to resolving the climate crisis that we helped cause, like that's woefully inadequate. How did we decide that that's the our inadequate solution? How did we come to celebrate that inadequate solution, you know?
Right.
And the answer actually is...
This was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.